I also just want to acknowledge that we're sitting and resting on the land of the Nisenan and Miwok peoples, and that it's important, I think, to feel our gratitude for the thousands of years these tribal peoples cared for the land that we are now practicing on. So tonight we've chanted the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, and I like to think of this song as kind of a bullion cube of both the nature of the Dharma, the truth of the Dharma, and the method of practice, the method of realizing this truth. It's both. And we chanted the whole chant, but I want to bring the first part of the chant back to our memory as we're going forward this morning, or this afternoon, over this evening. So it starts out, "The teaching of suchness has been intimately communicated by Buddhas and ancestors. Now we have it. Keep it well. Filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight. Taken as similar, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. It is bright just at midnight. It doesn't appear at dawn. It acts as a guide for beings. Its use removes all pains. For it is like a massive fire. Suchness is like a massive fire." So I just have been wondering myself and want us to wonder together, well, you know, how is it that suchness is like a massive fire? How is it that this emptiness of all things, beyond comprehension, illimitable, ungraspable, is like a massive fire? So I'd like us to just sort of sit with that question. You know, how could it be, or what does it mean that the emptiness is like a massive fire? And we don't have answers exactly, but just share what comes to mind in response to this question, just like a word or like a sentence or a phrase.
Out of control.
Out of control. Uh-huh.
Out of consuming.
All consuming.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Turning away and touching are both wrong. Mm-hmm. Grasping or trying to hold on to stuff or trying to withdraw from such from our experience.
From our experience. So massive fire, you would say, maybe, is our experience of suchness. Anything else that just comes up? I mean,
A bright light.
Mm-hmm. Anyone on Zoom have something that just pops up? Barbara?
Heat.
Oh, thank you. Heat. Yes, heat. Larry.
It's more of a question.
Yeah.
I understand that touching a fire can be a big problem.
Uh-huh.
But you would think people would, you know, to turn away, I suppose that could be a big problem as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so, and it's hard to say what massive fire is in a way? Or why would the Dharma be like a massive fire? I'm checking on Zoom, but maybe Anthony, if you see somebody, you'll let me know too. Okay. Yeah, I thought of like ignite, quicken, maybe something sparks. So we're living with this question, yes, Millard.
The thing that's interesting to me about massive fire, it makes the same sound as a flag in a strong wind.
A massive fire makes the same sound as the wind, a strong wind blowing through a flag. Okay, well, let's Oscar.
Another thing about a massive fire is it's all consuming. Everything is being consumed and turned into something else all the time.
You have to have fuel. You have to have fuel.
We are the fuel. Everything is the fuel.
Yeah, so I've sort of started to think that there's this massive fire of suchness, which we want to explore, but there's another kind of fire too. That's this way that it feels like maybe the world's on fire. I mean, every day we're confronted with war and destruction and bombing whole cities and killing people and just walking in winters along a path in the country. There's a whole homeless camp there, just there. And, you know, just walking out, somebody said, just walking outside our door, you know, we're confronted with challenges and difficulties and, you know, tragedy or the death of a loved one. And this weekend I facilitated the internment of the ashes of a 23-year-old girl who died of a accidental overdose. I mean, these are all kind of fires of, you know, our human condition. And many fires, it seems like, are fueled by greed or hate or delusion. Like, we don't want to suffer, and so we create suffering in the world. So, you know, we can contribute to this potential to harm each other. And I feel this when I walk out the door, and I maybe most of us do. And sometimes I become really overwhelmed, almost frantic, like, you know, what should I do? There's so much to do. Where do I start? And actually, I in a way, this other idea of fire hits me just when I talk to people, because a lot of times people's speech has this way that there's pessimism in the way people talk often, or there's sort of dualities, like blaming this group and blaming that group, and predicting the future. There's a need to sort of think that we know what's going to happen, and therefore this is how I should act. And in a way, I think we become numb to expressions of hatred, bullying language. It's almost like we all have PTSD, because maybe we go numb inside and dissociate from our embodiment. So there's this kind of fire, I guess, that is part of our human life. And I've been reading this book by Susan Murphy. It's called A Fire Runs Through All Things. Do you know that book? Zen Koans for Facing the Climate Crisis. And she lives in Australia. And so she was there in Australia during the 6-month Australian fire in 2019-20. And I just wanted to share a couple of things that she said. She said, "We were obliged to learn a newly coined word," and I'm going to try my best, "pyrocumulonimbus." And this is the name for the towering thunderheads of superheated smoke that crowned the skies for months. These fire clouds were born of firestorms so intense, they created their own weather system, producing freakish rainfall amid the dry lightning that continued to spark fresh outbreaks in advance of the massive fire front. And then after the fires, there were floods that destroyed the root systems of the plants because they were already so vulnerable. So just this description kind of brings home again, you know, massive fire, things out of control. And then she said they created another new word, solastalgia. Solastalgia, the grief for the loss of precious places, landscapes, creatures, ecosystems, describing the indigenous sorrow for places desecrated by fires, floods, storms, drought, as well as the loss of habitats due to development. It's like, I mean, it is overwhelming. But we could say, and she says, that we have a crisis of the mind, that we tend to divide the world to manage our pain. We turn to abstractions and dualisms to explain our world crisis. We stay on the surface of our reactivity, and we cannot rest in the undivided mind. We cannot rest in the undivided mind. So this is where I think we want to return now to the Jhulmir Samadhi and to the original question. What is it about suchness that's like a massive fire? And how do we attend to this truth of the fire that runs through all things? And some of you have already named this, because in the Jewel Mirror, it basically says, because suchness is like a massive fire, turning away and touching are both wrong. So, you know, I was thinking about physical fires, turning away. If we don't attend to the fire, we don't pay attention to what's burning, making sure it's contained, it's a kind of neglect to turn away from a fire. We're not taking responsibility for the fire. You know, we don't clear the underbrush, we don't fix the electricity. That's a turning away. I don't want to suffer. So in turning away, we need to consider recognizing our defenses. And I was very struck by Kokyo at the Saturday talk. He said, fixed views, or what we think something is, he said, actually functions on an unconscious level. So whatever fixed views that are sort of behind our actions, it's, we're not necessarily aware of it. And so this is sort of what we're being asked in our practice, to become aware of what, you know, is going on underneath, you know, like denial, for example. A friend of mine was expressing a strong opinion about something, and I didn't really agree with her. And so we were kind of like this, and I found myself, I wasn't even aware of it at first, but I found myself just very subtly cooling off, kind of pulling back and staying with a certain judgment. But I didn't know that at first. It's like I became aware, and you know, it's the inner work, I guess. It's the, what we do for our practice life to not turn away. Making generalizations is another way to turn away, because we can, it's more comfortable to make a generalization because we know, and it doesn't necessarily relate to us, yet we also, by turning away, we may judge ourselves as inadequate too. We turn away because, I registered some college students to, or I was trying to register some college students to vote. And a lot of the college students said, well, yeah, I registered. And then I said, well, did you vote? And most of them said no. And, they had different reasons, but many of them said, I just felt like I didn't know enough. So the sense of not feeling adequate can also be a way of turning away. So perhaps one way of practicing with this tendency to turn away is to ask ourselves, just in the moment, do I believe that everything I'm doing right now matters? Do I believe that everything I'm doing right now matters? That's sort of the antidote to turning away, because you're valuing every moment of your life and you're valuing yourself. So practicing with this question could quicken a vital attentiveness to each moment of our lives, a kind of tending to the fire of aliveness, because we're really saying, how do we tend to this massive fire? Not by turning away and not by touching, but maybe by this kind of present awareness of the preciousness of each moment. So getting too close also impacts the aliveness of fire and can cause harm. Of course, we wouldn't normally want to put our hands into a fire, literally, and get burned, but we are careless. I was in Africa when I was like 19 with a group of people, and one of the guys in the group had this crazy idea to take kerosene and throw it on the fire to make the fire stronger. I mean, he just did it, and my whole, a lot of my hair just singed. So people are careless. I mean, we can be impulsive with fire sticks. We see kids running around with fire sticks. So, it's being careful, caring. Also, if you have too many logs piled up on each other, the fire goes out, basically. It's too tight. It's too held on that a fire stays light if there's oxygen in between the logs, if there's like a space. So we can also practice to create space around whatever we're reacting to before we speak, just to kind of settle back in, to rest in the undivided mind, which gives space around what we're doing. So we may... Another way to consider this whole question of practicing with the massive fire is to consider the paradox of becoming congruent with suffering. So many of you have heard of Vimalakirti, the story of Vimalakirti, who was a very wealthy lay person who was a lay teacher. A master teacher, and the story goes that Vimalakirti was in his 10x10 room, and he was very sick, and everybody was like afraid, like, how come you're so sick? Because you're a master teacher, you should be able to heal yourself. And so finally Manjushri went to the Buddha and said, what should I do? Because Vimalakirti is sick, and we don't know how to help him. And so Manjushri said, well, why don't you just go back and ask Vimalakirti, why are you sick? And Vimalakirti said, I'm sick because the whole world is sick. I'm sick because the whole world is sick. And when we sit zazen, we're sitting with all beings. We suffer with the whole world, not from our reactivity and our fear. We sit with the whole world from our undivided wholeness. And we heal because we transcend our individuality. For we are no longer an I. We're a we, suffering together, letting go of the delusion of the separate self. So Susan Griffin says, let this pain of suffering with the world endanger our isolated sense of self. And I learned through her that Vimalakirti's name means untainted fire. Untainted fire. So he was free of all of those hindrances that get in the way, our unconscious defense mechanisms, our need to be a separate self. He was free, and that gave him the courage to sit with all beings, but without being consumed by the fire. Maybe you've had these experiences too, but they still feel uncanny to me. Along these lines of the paradox of becoming congruent with suffering, and when COVID was first so virulent and people were dying all over the world and families couldn't see their loved ones when they were dying, I went to this meditation at Spirit Rock, and the woman there who led the meditation, we basically were sitting zazen for quite a long while. So we were invited to rest in this undivided mind. And then she guided us through like a metta practice where we were, you know, in a sense offering, you know, metta for the people who had died, the people who were sick, who were, you know, on oxygen machines, all the families that couldn't come to their loved ones. I mean, the practice just was including the whole world. And then at the end of the meditation, this is the uncanny. I just felt so alive. I felt like free and alive, and like I had all this energy to go out into the world, you know, and care for the world. So that paradox, I think, is real, you know, that the, by being congruent with the suffering, we also become, you know, filled with the fire of suchness. And just one more story. And this is from Dogen's extensive record. So this is a, sort of a record of his more short talks. And maybe you've heard this talk. And it's a dialogue between Bai Zhang, who was a Zen master, and Gishan, who was his student. And Gishan served as head monk. And one cold winter evening, Bai Zhang came upon Gishan in the monk's hall. He was alone, sitting in deep meditation. The room was so dark, Bai Zhang couldn't make out Gishan's face. Bai Zhang said, "Who is sitting there in the dark?" Gishan replied, "It's your student, Gishan." "It's so cold and dark in here. Would you poke through the ash in the stove and see if there are some burning embers to restart the fire?" said Bai Zhang. Gishan did as he was asked. He turned to Bai Zhang and said, "There are no embers left in the ash." Master Bai Zhang walked over to the fire, grasped the tongs, and dug deeply into the ash. After a short time, he found a tiny glowing ember. He held it up and turned to Gishan. You said there is no fire left. What is this? At that moment, Gishan had an awakening. So we could wonder now, in what ways might I be only seeing the surface ash, what appear to be the dark aspects of our lives or crises in the world, turning away rather than digging deeper to find the tiny glowing ember calling out to be nurtured, fueled by our attention and presence. Remember, we're tending to the fire. Or are we going to sit alone in a dark, cold room, forgetting that there's always a stove of community ready to respond to our suffering? We are constantly in unfamiliar territory without answers. This is a call to ignite our practice life. This sitting zazen is the method. Living in the not knowing of full presence, going beyond our wish for personal fulfillment to attending to the fire of wisdom arising right now at one with all beings. Thank you. Larry.
Yeah. You ask a question, and you know, I have to spend 16 hours pondering it. So I'm still pondering.
Yeah.
But something has come to me, and this is a question I've had before. Well, what is this fire they're talking about? Mm-hmm. You know, touching it, but turning away. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it just occurs to me that, you know, the teaching handed down to us is that all things are without identity on their own. Mm-hmm. So the fire, you might think of it as a fire because we have a concept of fire in our head. Mm-hmm. But what if fire is just representative of energy, dynamic mm-hmm. movement of energy? Mm-hmm. So as we approach our life in these various little fires that we have, not to touch and not to turn away, what happens to a fire naturally is it extinguishes itself.
Oh.
You don't have to touch. You don't have to turn away. Uh-huh. See, I kept thinking of something burning, like a house burning. Mm-hmm. You don't want to turn away from a house that's burning. You want to do something about it. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe it seems that the word fire in this context of this sutra is not that something is burning that we have to worry about. It's mm-hmm. just a massive fire. Mm-hmm. It's energy that extinguishes itself. Mm-hmm. So without thinking about what is burning, just think of what is the nature of fire.
Yes, and you don't want to turn away from that.
No, exactly.
Yes.
So. Thank
it's
you.
A different kind of turning away, not turning away, I think is what you're saying too. Yeah. If it's the energy of impermanence, it's the energy of non-fixed identity, it's life moving.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Jim.
What came to me during your talk was a teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and that I read a long time ago. And so the etymology of the word for the Third Noble Truth, or the truth that there is an end to suffering, the word is samudaya. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but samudaya. And it means to bank up a fire. it means to, you know, like how you would put a earthen ring around a fire to keep it, you know, burning and in control. Mm-hmm. So that came to me as and also then when Larry was talking about, I thought about the Lotus Sutra, and the story of the burning house. Mm-hmm. Right, it says, you know, the Buddha's children are in the house and it's burning, and he doesn't want to go in there, you know, and get close to it because he'll get burned. And but I can't turn away either because his children are in the house. So he coaxes them out of the house with the offer of beautiful ox carts to play with. So there's that thought too.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I was going to talk about that story too, but it's on the one hand, our house is burning. I mean, if we're stuck in our fears and our greed and our, you know, anxiety about whatever's coming next, that's sort of like we're caught in the house that's on fire, because there is a way to get free of that so that we're, you know, open. And we're also interconnected. We're no longer fearful in the same way of losing our own identity, I think. But it's the practice. It's not just talking about it. I guess that's what seems so important, that, you know, igniting our fire of practice life, what will help us, you know, sit more regularly or sit a little longer, or, you know, because I think getting to that space of samadhi, of undivided mind, is what, you know, the fire doesn't consume us, really. We're just participating. Any other questions or thoughts, or anybody on Zoom?
Just an observation that there's quite a few images of fire in the liturgy. And I can't quote the cases or the dramatist personae, but there's the suggestion that a student should practice as if his or her hair were on fire. So strong images, and the idea of if you're not practicing, one day you'll be like a crab boiled, you know, dropped into the hot water. Another image, but I'm blanking out on it right now. But this strong imagery the teachers have used over the millennia to impress the student with the immediacy of the energy that we're surrounded with and part of.
Yes, as you're talking, I'm thinking too, another kind of turning away is to stop practicing. I mean, we can get sort of discouraged or, you know, despaired or out of helplessness of what's happening in the world. You know, we stay in that kind of, you know, stress response syndrome, and we don't remember, you know, go sit. Sit in the wellspring of life and be open to the undivided mind. And, you know, I don't know if you've had those experiences of where you've had kind of a resistance to sitting, actually. And then what happens if you, you know, notice that, you know, because resistance is also a kind of turning away. If you can be aware that quickening of tending the fire, then maybe you'll help yourself sit, even though that initial resistance is there. And you sit, and John Kabat-Zinn says, and Miao Lehi says, then get out of the way. And if you don't like it, you still do it. So you resist the tendency to say, oh, well, this isn't a good meditation, I'm going to get up now, or all those ways in which we, turn away or get so consumed by our own anxiety that we don't, open and let go. I mean, all those things are issues within our practice life itself. I don't know if anyone's had experiences like that where, the more dramatic experience of not practicing and then, coming back to that intention and how that affects you. Yes, Malia.
I think of fire along the lines of what you're talking about as kind of the unleashing of energy, or like the freeing of energy. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense to me. But I wanted to share that there's a book by the author Rebecca Solnit, and I can't remember the title of the book, but it's about disasters. And she talks a lot about the massive fire in 1919 in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And she collects all these personal accounts of people who were there, anecdotes and whatnot. And all of these displaced people, were just moving across the city. And it brought out this really remarkable compassion in both the people who were fleeing and the people who were being fled to. And it's really very striking. And so she was struck by that. And then she started looking at disasters in other parts of the world and notice the same pattern. Just thinking about fire and freeing and
what is it that quickens that ability to be compassionate too? Mm-hmm. I mean, you're saying in a way that kind of devastation on one level also broke through to something deeper that evoked compassion in people that maybe had never discovered that before. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that kind of resonates with, becoming congruent with suffering, becoming, allowing the tragedies and so forth to be in our awareness, because then we are free to cultivate compassion. And if we don't feel compassion, then we're not in our practice life. We're reacting out of fear or greed or. Yeah, I know Sarah's thinking over there, but anybody on Zoom? I can't. Nobody?
Okay. Well, also you could say that the teacher is the fire. And some people are reluctant to go see the teacher, I know somebody that felt bad their whole life because they were around when Suzuki Roshi was around, mm-hmm. but they didn't have the courage to go talk to him. It was like too big a fire. Mm-hmm. There's too much fire there, mm-hmm. So the teacher is kind of the embodiment of suchness. And so I don't know about touching, I mean, you can't really, you can't also really be friends with the teacher either. I mean, there's a certain distance that you have to keep from the teacher. You can't just try to glom on to the teacher either. So it's kind of like the respectful distance or something, wanting to be, just close enough, but not too close, and not too close for the comfort of the teacher either, so just that right that right distance.
And that's when the fire of, you know, enlightenment can actually be transmitted here in a way.
Maybe so, yeah.
Yeah. When that space is there and the respect.
Maybe that's what happened with Baijiang and Guishan. Uh-huh. Just the right distance. Oh, okay. Here's the ember.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's a whole other thing. Like, my teacher used to say to me, whatever comes first, you know, in your inner mind that it gets arisen, don't stop there. You know, that's just the surface. You know, he says, what did he say? Would you poke through the ash in the stove and see if there are some burning embers to restart the fire? Guishan said, there are no embers left in the ash. That would be sort of the surface, you know, level of what will start to arise in our sitting. But Master Baijiang grasped the tongs and dug deeply into the ash. And that's when he found a glowing ember. So that to know that we have layers, and we just keep going down the layers, and that's where the gold is. But that's, again, the sort of patience and stick-to-itiveness of sitting, really, for that kind of transformation to happen. Thank you all for listening and sharing.